Crises include colonization, historical trauma, racism, and sexual objectification. The final report of the National Inquiry into MMIWG concluded that the violence is caused by the state's actions and inactions, which are deeply rooted in colonialism and colonial ideologies. As we reflect 5 years later, despite having poured millions of dollars into this inquiry, despite having heard over 750 voices, many are left questioning what tangible changes have occurred for Indigenous women and girls.
So I don't actually know that much about the National Inquiry that took place. I don't know how much you know of it.
I think she says it, yeah, actually, in that little soundbite there, where, you know, what is discovered the most is that it exists as an issue and an ongoing issue because of action and inaction.
Yeah.
And that the action, when we think about it, isn't necessarily the action that makes change either, right? Like sometimes we think about inaction as the thing that is the barrier to change. But sometimes it's the action that's actually the barrier to change also. And, you know, we've talked about it tons on Intravenous, where you can't have policy come out of a certain kind of thinking that looks different than that thinking looks. And so when you've got a bunch of white men in an ivory tower on a hill making policy, that policy is going to look pretty good for the white men on the hill.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's going to serve their belief system and their value system and their needs and wants. And even if it's written in a way that, you know, points in the direction of, you know, caretaking or, you know, making change or whatever, it's still being interpreted then by people who perhaps, and this is changing slowly because we're seeing more lawyers and judges that, you know, are of color and have a different experience. But this change from the top down is slow. And it's not going to change when we still have, you know, this dominant ideology that believes that rape culture is okie dokie.
Yeah.
And that lens with which we see how it's insidious in our culture also is rose colored and murky and what are you talking about? And I'm going to support my bro because we're bros. And so it's challenging. For sure. I think then the number, you know, there was a lot of attention back at the time when the inquiry was called, and a lot of attention to the inaction to the inquiry as well. It took forever. It wasn't being done in a sufficient or way that felt like the issue was being honored as something imperative. And even now, I think that those numbers, as we talked about just in general in terms of violence against women, those numbers probably aren't going down.
Yeah.
My guess is that they're probably also going up because if violence against women is going up, the most vulnerable are the ones that affects.
Yeah.
You know, the ones that are already being targeted for, you know, the things that she talked about in the soundbite. You know, we're all victims of colonialism, but really, you know, like damaging genocide victims of colonialism. And, you know, racialization and historic trauma and, you know, all of these things that put people in a position to be more vulnerable than not are going to experience the most violence.
Yeah. And I think...
And that's not changing.
Oh, no, yeah. And at the end of that soundbite, her saying, "What has tangibly been done since the inquiry?" And I haven't delved too much into it in looking at what has been done, but I can compare it to back home. We've had a lot of inquiries go into the Met Police, Metropolitan Police, and it's pretty much all along the same lines in terms of kind of racial discrimination, gender discrimination. They have all been along those lines, and there was a famous one called the McPherson Inquiry that happened late 1990s, early 2000s, in response to a young black boy that was murdered in 1997, called Stephen Lawrence, and it was the inquiry into how the police handled the case, in terms of none of his killers were brought to justice until 10 years ago, something like that, and even then only two of them were, and there were six that were suspected. And you look at that, at how they handled that, and it led into a whole inquiry into institutionalized racism within the police, and they had to have another inquiry this year into institutionalized racism in the police.
And you just think about the bureaucracy that is, and how do you get yourself out from underneath that kind of bureaucracy to get to tangible solutions?
Yeah, because their tangible solution was, oh, we'll add in educational classes into their training and to not be racist. And there was an undercover journalist that did a documentary into it, and he attended it. It was just after the McPherson inquiry. And yes, they went to the classes and attended the classes, but when he, as he was pretending to be a police officer in training, had social time with these officers in training, he was like, they're just as racist, just not in front of the teachers. And it was caught on camera. And I think, so your tangible solution of having classes into being not racist, it's not a tangible solution because it's not doing anything. They openly said in this documentary, they're like, oh, I would definitely be stopping over every so-and-so person because odds are they're going to have something on them that they shouldn't, just based on their race. And it was like, really? Like, just openly saying it. But the police was like, but it's okay, we're not institutionally racist because we've got lessons now on how to not be. It just seemed like the most absurd kind of solution that they could come up with, to the point that they have another national inquiry into it. And I don't know fully what the results are of it now, but they had a lot of anonymous police officers from a BAME background that came forward to talk about their treatment in the police, saying, we're not being discriminated now in terms of recruitment or anything, but we are in how we're treated when we're there. So it's kind of, it's changed. So in terms of, you look at the statistics of the ethnic demographic.
Like the representation.
Yeah. And the statistics would be like, oh yeah, the Met Police isn't racist at all. Look at the statistics. But it's now, they're having to come forward, and they're coming forward anonymously for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get known that they are still institutionally racist in terms of the treatment that happens once you're in. So yeah, I think like the similarities in terms of what has tangibly been done as a solution that's working is you're not seeing it. And I feel like sometimes these inquiries and reviews are kind of like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound type of thing.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a saying about how the government is, if the government can't just throw money at it, then it doesn't know what to do.
Yeah.
You know? And basically opening up an inquiry or a review is throwing money at it because you're, you know, hiring all these experts to, you know, figure out what the problem is and then, you know, list out a bunch of solutions that then take money to implement these solutions. And but when it comes to actually, like nitty gritty down and dirty, getting the work done to turn this way of being around, that takes a lot more than money.
And it's like I think they said in the clip that there was like 200 and something recommendations that were made.
231 recommendations. Yeah. Yeah, not unlike the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, just, you know, a few years beforehand, who recommended 293.
Yeah.
And they're still, you know, barking to have those recognized and instituted on a level where we're seeing the kinds of change that is required.
Yeah.
So,
definitely. Yeah, this next soundbite is hearing more from one of the panelists. I briefly mentioned it earlier, but it is her answer to the question that was, what do you think should be the immediate actions concerning the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls? And it's a story that, to her, highlighted the importance of the work she's been doing and the urgency for safe spaces for these people to have access to.
I want to take you back just a while back. It was not that long ago that Summerain and Joanne and I received a call of a young woman that was trafficked about 2.5 months ago. We got the call from Senator Michelle Odette of this young woman. We don't even have to, we just dropped everything. We went, you know, and it took us just a networking. Why I'm bringing this up is we have those safe spaces to bring these young women when we do find them. One of the things that we have witnessed is that when, thank God, for Summer and for Joanne, because there's just two of us that went out there. The only thing that we had, it looked like a pen, and it was a taser that we were carrying. So when we got to this place, we didn't know what we were walking into. Again, after Summer had everything all set up, Joanne, thank God, and she spoke French too, because I don't speak any of that. And like this young girl, she came back from northeast Quebec. She ran away, 18 years old, ended up in Quebec City, and she was taken from there. On the promissory that they were going to take good care of her, make sure she has money, and all the things you want to hear, I spoke to my boss is here, Heather Scarf from Otari, and I said, I need to do this, and she said, you do what you need to do. And then, long story short of it, she was moved from one place to another. And there's just two of us there. And we recognized that there was four men. One was hiding in a vehicle. Everything is timing. But we managed to get her out of there. But we didn't realize that she, on her phone, they were tracking her. Thank God again, Summerain and Joanne. Everything was timing. Anyways, we managed to get her out. She was safe. She had to be moved twice, the last place. And then the calls were made back east. SQ and the RCMP, they work together with one of the speakers in the House, along with Senator Michelle Odette. We had her on that plane the following morning. I've never felt fear like that. I've been on the front line since 1986. Why I'm bringing this up, we need immediate action for a safe place to bring these young men, young girls, our children. Because if we didn't have like, the connections that we do here, she was already, I mean, like they had already brainwashed her. There was a lot of hesitation. But again, thank God, and for Joanne that speaks fluent French and had to sum her up with her contacts, we don't know what would have happened. So that is part of it, the 231 calls for justice and action here. We've been asking, I'm a family member. My mother was murdered down here. Three of my sisters were. I have a baby sister that was murdered in Merritt. And to this day, since my work, my goal in life was to apprentice under world-renowned Bill Reed. That's where I was. That was my destiny right there. And my whole life changed. And I can honestly tell you, since I've been working down here at 86 on the front lines, nothing has changed. We still don't have any safe places for us to bring these young women. We've been asking for a health, healing, and wellness center. Yeah, the city's got all their blah, blah, blah. That's not what we're talking about. That may be great for the inner city here, but what we're talking about is the health, healing, and wellness that would be, we would bring in our own elders, our spiritual people, land-based healing in that. That's what we're talking about. But to this day, we have got no safe place to bring them. We aren't even safe on the front lines anymore. It's a war zone down here. We've been doing the grid searches, again, up in Seminar. We weren't even there 5 minutes. We went up to Curtis Sagbones. To me, he is the copycat killer to Robert Willie Picton. But that does not even phase the RCMP.
So that is a very, I think, hard-hitting soundbite of the reality of the situation that is happening.
It's heartbreaking is what it is. It's absolutely heartbreaking to know that, A, she's been doing this since 1986, mm-hmm. and that nothing has changed in her purview.
Yeah.
But also that the reason she does this work is because she's had so many of her family members murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps in front of her.
Yeah.
Perhaps not. But it doesn't matter. The fact is that I can't even imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I can't imagine what that does to your soul and to your psyche to just live with that and to have to take it on as your own fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's no one who will take it up for you. And, you know, again, I think back to my time in Winnipeg, and there was a rash of murders of Indigenous women and girls. And Tina Fontaine became this very famous case.
Mm-hmm.
And others like her and following her and before her, and they they started this project to, like, the Indigenous community started this project to comb the Red River themselves. And so, you know, Johnny had a boat, and, you know, Cousin Joe had a net, and someone else had time, and Athena cooked chili for the folks who were on the sidelines rallying, and it just became this very grassroots community effort to bring home their people, so that they could at least have some kind of closure, even, you know? And we're not even talking justice. We're just talking about closure and knowing what happened to your loved people. So it's... Yeah, I guess it comes back to that, you know, where are the tangible solutions, and how do we have a system that is, you know, government, police oriented, what have you, that is giving us the kind of action versus inaction that we really need to solve these problems of violence against women and girls. And, you know, as this last woman was speaking about, the ability to have somewhere to bring them that is a safe space so that they can be deprogrammed, right? Because there's a whole mechanism of, you know, belief system that surrounds, you know, trafficking and prostitution, and how you believe these people to be your caregivers.
Yeah.
You know? And that idea that is what love looks like then, you know, like it all gets polluted and skewed.
Yeah, and I think as well with what she was specifically saying, in that they need a safe space and a healing space that is
driven by them.
I was trying to think of the way of phrasing it, but yeah, driven by them, not what the government feels is what they need. In that, she's saying, I remember when we watched one of the Antio videos and the importance of Indigenous owned practices in medicine and healing, and how important that is for them and their culture, and that it, a lot of westernized medicine is sort of derived from that, but they need that from their own elders, and that's what she's saying, is that they need in order to help all of these women and girls, not what the federal government would want to do or like want to put up. I've listened to this soundbite probably multiple times. It doesn't get any easier listening to it. And how she is having to continue this fight. I mean, we don't know when she lost her loved ones through this, but it's the fact that she's probably been continuing this fight in their names for God knows how many years, and for her to have to sit there and say nothing's changed in that whole time. And she's still willing to fight for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a tremendous amount of strength and courage and belief that one day things will be different and that the system will change and that there is hope for it to change. Yeah. I mean, the next soundbite that I had, it was about a minute and 20 seconds. It was kind of, it's the same woman. It was kind of a continuation of the story, but she was talking about the need for the funding to also help the families affected, and that it's not just a safe place for those that have experienced and suffered these horrific things, but also for the families. Because she said she'd spoken a lot with families, and it's like, we're trying to support them as well as the victims. And there's just not enough support, there's not enough funding, and just not enough being done. And the common theme is just not enough.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because whenever something happens to us, it happens to our community. You know, it affects the people that we're close to in different ways, absolutely, mm-hmm. but in ways that they also are trying to incorporate and integrate and reckon with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when people disappear, for sure, and when people die, it's one of those things that ripples out into every aspect of, you know, what happens in the community, especially in tight-knit communities. Mm. And so that need for funding for families, I think, is a good call. I don't know if that's part of the, you know, what was decided about the inquiry, but yeah.
Then it's the need for the impact that happens to the victims and to everyone surrounding it, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's best if we actually finish on your song that you suggested, in a way of kind of closing this very hard-hitting, heartbreaking sort of topic. But the song that you had suggested, would you say it was a new song?
It's brand new.
Brand new.
Yeah. It's called Volcano by Tessa Posner. Mm. I don't know too much about it. I listened to it and it seemed to be a little bit of a powerhouse. She talks about herself being like, what if I was a volcano and just, you know, had this kind of potency and power to me? And maybe that's a good way to end off, is just
what
with
if
a little
all women were volcanoes with this power. But yeah.